This is the TTY Dialer, episode 37, for the week of July 10th through July 15th. Hello, welcome to the TTY Dialer podcast. I'm Mark Livonier. This is your weekly companion to WRVO Public Media's nightly old-time radio show tuned to yesterday, where we bring you the golden age of radio, comedy, drama, mystery, romance, thrills, true history, and more. And you can hear it live from 10 to midnight on the air, and a second stream via our website, WRVO2. In this podcast, I bring you a mix of radio history, fun with sound from the past, and a look at the shows coming up for the week.
Now here's Don Wilson again with some really good news.
You're buying a television set. You want the best your money can buy, right? You look at a lot of different sets, you hear a lot of technical double talk, and you're completely confused. Then you see one set with a tag on it, a tag reading, engineered by CBS Columbia. You think to yourself,
CBS, big television network, radio broadcasting, records. They ought to know what they're doing.
You're so right. CBS, the greatest name in home entertainment, has developed America's most advanced TV set. Pictures so brilliantly sharp, you think you're in the studio itself. The fact is, only CBS, with its tremendous engineering and electronics background, could produce the exciting new CBS Columbia TV set.
That was a commercial for a show that featured one of the top 10 singers in the country at that time of that episode in 1952. It was for the Doris Day radio show, which featured a blend of songs and movie star guests from Hollywood. And its commercials, in a way, marked the move audiences were making from what used to be the main form of daily entertainment, which was radio. And in the 50s, watching screens, whether it was movies or television, was pretty popular, and Doris Day had already appeared in 13 movies leading up to her series. And by the end of her radio show, less than a year after it first hit the air, she was featured sort of on both screens in a movie comedy short called So You Want a Television Set. She made a cameo appearance with singer Gordon McRae as a way to promote their movie in theaters at the time. And his radio show, The Railroad Hour, on the air, was becoming reduced to recycled productions from previous broadcasts. And although it makes sense why it happened, there does seem to be a certain irony when there's advertising for television on the radio, as TV was the medium that would end up drawing audiences away from radio programs in droves. And many years after that clip of the Doris Day radio show, she would star in her own sitcom-style show from 1968 to 1973, her last acting job. Television was advertised heavily on the air, with one show in particular that was following the trend as it had a TV counterpart to its ongoing radio show, and that was Amos and Andy.
What's more, you can get sweep tuning in a 21-inch CBS TV set for only $149.95. Hey, where are you going there, Andy?
Gotta get to my dealer before he sold out of them CBS sweep tuning sets.
Yeah, wait a minute here. Take your old set along with you. Get yourself a real nice trade-in.
Coming up this Monday on Tuned to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, it's an hour of comedy. We'll hear Jack Benny and comedian Danny Thomas as guest on Joan Davis Time. After that, true history from You Are There and the Cavalcade of America. And on Tuesday night at 10, drama from Suspense and the Columbia Workshop. A powerful story from Archibald MacLeish called The Fall of the City. Really must listen to radio from 1937. At 11 o'clock, it's crime with Counter Spy. And then an episode of Dragnet from 1950.
Stakeouts were set up at locations where sales and deliveries of obscene material were known to have been made. Nothing happened. The drive stalled. Thursday, June 11th.
Amara?
Joe?
Yes, Gabriel?
First piece of news in the month. Policewoman just called it in.
Yeah?
Lois Bruce's girlfriend, Joyce Fowler?
Yeah?
She's been found.
Here are these programs Monday, July 10th, and Tuesday, July 11th. They're on the air live from 10 to midnight on WRVO. And this Monday, July 10th, is the birthday of probably the most famous radio announcer in history, at least during its infancy, who has been associated with many firsts in broadcasting, Graham McNamee. He was world famous and known for his broadcasts in the States from the people who listened to them, but also as reported in the news and at times heard on shortwave. Among the earliest surviving recordings of McNamee include the first time music was heard in a coast-to-coast broadcast, which was during a reception for Charles Lindbergh returning from an overseas flight on June 11, 1927.
And now the National Broadcasting Company and associated radio stations who are putting on this program by radio are going to ask you to just listen to the band for a few moments because particularly this is the first time band music or music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast, which is another epoch. We will listen to the band.
McNamee was also among radio's first sportscasters. He first performed play-by-play coverage at the 1923 World Series at the Polo Grounds in New York. This would inspire generations of what's turned into close to 100 years of this type of radio. He also emceed many boxing matches, like the famous Long Count fight with Jack Dempsey and Gene Tooney in 1927. McNamee was also the announcer on the sports-themed Coca-Cola Hour with now legendary sports writer Grant Lynn Rice. Around 20 million tuned in for that show every week. And in the early 1930s, he was heard on comedian Ed Wynn's Fire Chief program and proved in his role as announcer to be among the first radio straight men, with Wynn bouncing jokes off of him during the show.
Graham? Yeah? Tonight the opera is very unusual.
It would be.
You'll never even get over the title. The title of the opera is When You Were Eight, and I was 9, and we were 17.
The same model would be used in future shows by comedians like Red Skelton and Jack Benny. At the top of their programs, their announcers would set him up and they would knock him down. Graham McNamee was used for a variety of shows as staff announcer for mostly NBC, with regular gigs with Rudy Valli and specialty shows like Paul Whiteman's Birthday Party.
It is with an extra bit of feeling that I introduce Paul Whiteman at this time. For tonight, as we celebrate his birthday, a birthday that marks another milestone along a trail of melody that through the years has ever broadened in its scope, I look back upon many years of acquaintanceship with a man whom it has been my privilege and my pride to call a friend.
About a year before McNamee's death at the age of 53, he was still working often on the air in more narrative roles, like this pre-war episode of Defense for America in 1941.
I'm standing at the first stop on the now famous shortcut to Montreal. The Portland Pipeline, which is rapidly nearing completion. Not far out from shore, and you can probably hear their signals, a group of four great dredges are making life miserable for the fish and lobsters of Upper Casco Bay as they tear out great chunks of sea bottom to make room for the seagoing oil tankers that will discharge their cargoes here. All around me is that well-known scene of activity. Things are being done here, and in a big way, believe me. Tractors to the left of me, tractors to the right of me, and dredges out in front of me. I'm surrounded by what amounts to a paradise for an old 6th Avenue excavation watcher like myself. For here, where I stand now, is the beginning of the great pipeline that will carry oil to Montreal, Canada, saving the hard-pressed oil tankers a 10 or 12-day voyage and releasing them for the mighty important job of keeping America's Atlantic coast supplied with vital fuel oil. Most American motorists get an average of, somewhere near 16 miles per gallon of gasoline, as I used to call it occasionally. In my car, I just get about 8 miles per gallon, and I'm not fooling. Anyhow, you can see that I'm really 3 times as interested in the so-called gasoline shortage as you are.
It was also in that year of 1941 that McNamee became, in my estimation, radio's first old-time radio announcer, with a series that looked back in time by only about 10 years, with stories of the medium and recreations of shows long gone, and a program called Behind the Mic.
Behind the Mic salutes a program you loved. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud, a tradition of good programs that linger fondly in your memory. And so each week, we intend to bring you a star or a part of some program you used to hear, a program that you loved. Tonight, Behind the Mic salutes the old RKO Hour. One of the really top-notch programs of 10 years ago was this same RKO Theater of the Air. This was a program that was particularly dear to me because for some time I was its announcer.
Following that, Graham McNamee was just heard in clip shows and remembrances. One, when San Diego station KPO became KNBC and had an hour-long program dedicated to the history of the station.
Ernie, I'm remembering another big game. The Rose Bowl game of 1929. And a voice you'll never hear it again, excepting on old and scratched records. Graham McNamee, the most beloved of all announcers of all time.
This Wednesday night on Tune to Yesterday, July 12th at 10, it's Adventure, Marlena Dietrich in a rare radio series called Time for Love. then Orson Welles and the Lives of Harry Lime. And we'll hear him again this Wednesday in the 11 o'clock hour for the Hour of Broadway with the Campbell Playhouse bringing us Showboat.
Now, I've tried to make our radio version of Showboat as true to its original as possible, but don't worry, the Campbell Playhouse wouldn't dream of being so different as to do Showboat without Helen Morgan. Helen Morgan as Julie. Wonderful, wonderful Helen Morgan with an old song which is new to her, new to Showboat, and maybe even new to you. And then there's William Johnstone, who's playing Gaylord Ravenel, Ray Collins, who's playing Windy, and I'm playing Captain Andy Hawks. Finally, Edna Ferber herself, Edna Ferber, who wrote Showboat, comes to our microphone and begins tonight her career as an actress.
Thursday night, July 13th at 10, it's Horror from the Hermit's Cave and the Mysterious Traveler. Then a new block of sci-fi shows, X-1, and The Planet Man from 1953. I'll be bringing you two broadcasts from that series. So listen in if you can this Wednesday, July 12th and Thursday, July 13th from 10 to midnight on the air on Tune to Yesterday or as we stream live at WRVO.org. From books to the silver screen, the character introduced in Dashiell Hammett's 1930 novel, The Maltese Falcon, came to radio on this Wednesday, July 12th in 1946. Sam Spade has been regarded as one of the world's most famous fictional detectives, next to Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot and Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, though Spade was separated by probably around a metric ton of grit. He wasn't as complex as some of his fictional counterparts. He had a tough, to-the-point style of detective work that was really quickly embraced by pulp and pop culture. Only a year after the release of the Maltese Falcon book, the first of several movie adaptations was made of a missing bejeweled bird and the murderous, scheming path that it left in its wake as seedy underworld characters pursued it. And Sam Spade was caught in the middle after his partner was slain at the beginning of the mystery. Spade was cultivated, no pun intended, by an author who had plenty of investigative work under his hat that helped him drum up ideas for stories. Dashiell Hammett was part of the renowned and criminally feared Pinkerton Detective Agency in the 19-teens. After troubles with tuberculosis forced him away from physical work, he turned to writing and was able to start drawing an income from his short stories in the early 1920s. And by the time The Maltese Falcon was published, his career really took off, mainly with the Paramount Film Studio, where he was afforded a private limousine that would take him back and forth from the studio while on deadline for a script that he either wrote or was helping out with. Stories like his Thin Man series that featured the adventures of Nick and Nora Charles that were wildly popular in theaters, three of his movies based on the books. He even picked up an Oscar nomination for his screenplay for 1943's Watch on the Rhine that starred Betty Davis. From the famous noir picture The Glass Key with Veronica Lake to radio and movie detective The Fat Man, Dashiell Hammett in many ways set and even exceeded the standard of a hard-boiled detective. In the case of Sam Spade on radio, actor Howard Duff was recruited to play the lead role in the series, which, 5 years prior, was really immortalized in the movies by Humphrey Bogart's portrayal of Spade in what would be known as the definitive screen version of, take a guess, The Maltese Falcon.
My name is Spade, Sam Spade. License number 357896, issued by the Police Department of San Francisco. Occupation, private detective, sometimes known as Private Eye. My files in the case of the Maltese Falcon are closed, but I've got the Maltese Falcon. I got it and some dough. My partner got murdered and a very slick chick went up for life. I'll tell you about it.
Radio director William Spear took on the job, and he said he wanted to capture the attitude and atmosphere of Bogart. But at the urging of Spear's wife, he ended up choosing an out-of-type actor to play him on air. Howard Duff was previously best known for his comedy and more lighthearted roles in radio. Although the differences between the two actors were pretty stark, the adventures of Sam Spade turned out to be very successful on the air, in large part due to the chemistry of Duff and co-star Lorene Tuttle, who played his secretary Effie. She was heard in every broadcast with a mix of funny and frantic. Plus, the character who was ultimately on the side of the law, who wasn't afraid to bend it to get to the truth of a case, and in very much Sam Spade fashion, brought a hammer down in more ways than one when he or others in his line of work were betrayed. So here's some sound from one of the broadcasts of the series from 1948.
Per your instructions, promptly at 4 p.m. on the 15th inst, I must through the litter of your city room toward a door marked A.M. Youngblood, publisher, managing editor, and city editor. I wanted if you were ambitious, frugal, or three men. I did not know that you had good faith until I saw the trim, 20-ish, and toothsome secretary in your outer office.
Hello. You're new here, aren't you?
Well, I'm not exactly here. I'm just here to see Mr. Youngblood.
Oh.
The name is Spade.
Samuel Spade?
Sam, except for my most intimate friend.
Well, my advice to you, Sam, is to beat a hasty retreat. He's in a foul mood.
Oh? Why? Is he blind or older than he feels? I refer, of course, to your spectacular charm, Miss... if I may call you Miss.
Please, this is neither the time nor the place. My name is Phyllis Watson, and my phone number is in the directory, if you're really interested.
I could be.
Thank you. And if a man answers, tell him you're my French teacher.
Oui.
You better go in now. If you're late to an appointment with him, you're through.
Do you have any more words of wisdom?
No, but I hope you can do something to improve his state of mind. He's been awful lately. Good luck, Sam.
Thank you, Phyllis Watson.
Come in, come in. Now, 4:01. You must be Mr. Spade.
That's right.
You're almost late. Sit down, Spade. Cigar?
No, thanks.
Well, don't expect me to offer a drink. You aren't a drinker, I hope.
You don't listen to the radio, do you?
Well, you'll not drink in this office. Nothing here but a cooler filled with water from a clean, gurgling, laughing mountain stream.
You sound like a reformed drunk, Mr. Youngblood.
What's that? Well, it was a good many years ago. If you don't mind, I'll just paste up the weather report for my morning edition before we talk.
Oh, you do that too, huh?
Yes, obviously. And with good reasons. I remind myself that I was once a copy boy, and I find it a splendid way to, at least once each day, to lower myself to the level of the working man. There we are. Very hot in Phoenix, I see.
Mm-hmm. Just what do you want a detective for, Mr. Youngblood?
I was coming to that, Mr. Spade.
Sorry.
Now, well, first let me warn you that your assignment is a highly confidential one.
They all are.
In this case, a man's life may be at stake.
Mm-hmm.
The situation... My newspaper, at my order and under my guidance, has launched a campaign against crime. Not aimed at the petty criminal, but at the easy-living leeches at the controls of the rackets. The hoods in bankers' clothing. The mansion-house parasites who direct the pickpockets, the second-story men, the housebreakers, who gamble away $500,000
take it
a
easy.
Year and pay income taxes.
Don't go to pieces.
Of that amount.
Yes, I understand. I understand. You're after the boys on the safer side of the fences.
Nicely put, Spade.
Thank you.
Well, the long and short of it is this. The author of the expose series, Ray McCulley, my top crime reporter, has been missing for 2 days. I want you to find him.
What makes you think he's still alive?
Good heavens, Spade. Why must you suggest that he isn't?
Because if I were a mansion-housed parasite in danger of being unhoused by a newshawk, I'd see said newshawk standing in a cement block in the bottom of the bay.
I will accept that only when no stone has been left unturned. Every straw and every haystack has been searched. Every...
Nook and cranny?
Yes.
Sounds as though you need at least one police force, Mr. Youngblood. Now, why don't
No. Impossible. We've already had a brush with the police over the expose. I'll not be dictated to at this stage of the game. I started this investigation, and I'll finish it alone.
Well, it's a pretty big order, Mr. Youngblood, but times are tough. I'll see what I can do.
Good. I hereby turn over to you all the resources and power of this, my newspaper. When one of my reporters is in trouble or danger, sir, I will spend every penny of my fortune, if necessary, to deliver aid and succor to his side.
This Friday night on Tune to Yesterday at 10 o'clock, it's Hollywood Start Time with a Western story, Riders of the Purple Sage from 1946, then The Frontier Gentleman from 1958, two new shows to Tune to Yesterday. Then it's sitcoms at 11 with The Magnificent Montague and Lucille Ball in the show My Favorite Husband. This Saturday night, sci-fi from Quiet Please and an episode of Dimension X.
Action, Bravo, my helmet's stuck. It's too tight. Helmet's too tight.
You eat too much.
At least I ate. Not like Norman.
Yeah, look at him. Full armor and he's still smoking. I bet he lives on nicotine. Hey, Newman.
Yes?
You live on nicotine?
Tobacco is necessary to me.
Say that, a rope. What did I tell you?
All right, shut up and test your helmet radio. Snap it down.
Okay.
Now I'll get mine.
At 11 this Saturday, Horror from the Creaking Door and Creeps by Night with a story called The Hunt from 1944. Be sure to listen this Friday, July 14th, and Saturday, July 15th from 10 to midnight on Tuned to Yesterday. So that's going to do it for this week. Thanks a lot for listening to this TTY Dialer podcast. I'll be back next week with more stories from the past and a look at the shows coming up for the week. And if you have any questions or comments for me about this podcast or the Tune to Yesterday show, don't be afraid to email me. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. My address is mark@wrvo.org. That's M-A-R-K at wrvo.org. All right, until next week. I'll see you then.